Chapter 2 of Impressions of Theophrastus Such by George Eliot. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Josh Middledorf. Chapter 2, Looking Backward. Most of us who have had decent parents would shrink from wishing that our father and mother had been somebody else whom we never knew. Yet it is held no impiety, rather a graceful mark of instruction, for a man to wail that he has not the son of another age and another nation, of which also he knows nothing except through the easy process of an imperfect imagination and a flattering fancy. But the period thus looked back on with purely admiring regret as perfect enough to suit a superior mind is always a long way off. The desirable contemporaries are hardly nearer than Leonardo da Vinci. Most likely, they are the fellow citizens of Pericles, or, best of all, of the Aeolic lyrists, whose sparse remains suggest a comfortable contrast with our redundance. No impassioned personage wishes he had been born in the age of Pitt, that his ardent youth might have eaten the dearest bread, dressed itself with the longest coat-tails and the shortest waist, or heard the loudest grumbling at the heaviest war-taxes. And it would be really something original in polished verse if one of our young writers declared he would gladly be turned 85, that he might have known the joy and pride of being an Englishman when there were fewer reforms and plenty of highwaymen, fewer discoveries and more faces pitted with the smallpox, when laws were made to keep up the price of corn, and the troublesome Irish were more miserable. 3/4 of a century ago is not a distance that lends much enchantment to the view. We are familiar with the average men of that period, and are still consciously encumbered with its bad contrivances and mistaken acts. The lords and gentlemen painted by young Lawrence talked and wrote their nonsense in a tongue we thoroughly understand. Hence their times are not much flattered, not much glorified by the yearnings of that modern sect of flagellants who make a ritual of lashing not themselves, but all their neighbors. To me, however, that paternal time, the time of my father's youth, never seemed prosaic, for it came to my imagination first through his memories, which made a wondrous perspective to my little daily world of discovery. And for my part, I call no age absolutely unpoetic. How should it be so, since there are always children to whom the acorns, the swallow's eggs, are a wonder, always those human passions and fatalities through which Garrick as Hamlet in bobwig and knee-breeches moved his audience more than some have since done in velvet tunic and plume. But every age since the golden may be made more or less prosaic by minds that attend only to its vulgar and sordid elements, of which there are always an abundance, even in Greece and Italy, the favorite realms of the retrospective optimists. To be quite fair towards the ages, a little ugliness as well as beauty must be allowed to each of them, a little implicit poetry even to those which echoed loudest with servile, pompous, and trivial prose. Such impartiality is not in vogue at present. If we acknowledge our obligation to the ancients, it is hardly to be done without some flouting of our contemporaries, who, with all their faults, must be allowed the merit of keeping the world habitable for the refined eulogists of the blameless past. One wonders whether the remarkable originators who first had the notion of digging wells or of churning for butter, and who were certainly very useful to their own time as well as ours, were left quite free from invidious comparison with predecessors who let the water and the milk alone. Or whether some rhetorical nomad, as he stretched himself on the grass with a good appetite for contemporary butter, became loud on the virtue of ancestors who were uncorrupted by the produce of the cow. Nay, whether in a high flight of imaginative self-sacrifice, after swallowing the butter, He even wished himself earlier born and already eaten for the sustenance of a generation more naive than his own. I have often had the fool's hectic of wishing about the unalterable, but with me that useless exercise has turned chiefly on the conception of a different self, and not, as it usually does in literature, on the advantage of having been born in a different age, and more especially in one where life is imagined to have been altogether majestic and graceful. With my present abilities, external proportions, and generally small provision for ecstatic enjoyment, where is the ground for confidence that I should have had a preferable career in such an epoch of society? An age in which every department has its awkward squad seems in my mind's eye to suit me better. I might have wandered by the Strymon under Philip and Alexander without throwing any new light on method or organizing the sum of human knowledge. On the other hand, I might have objected to Aristotle as too much of a systematizer and have preferred the freedom of a little self-contradiction as offering more chances of truth. I gather, too, from the undeniable testimony of his disciple Theophrastus, that there were boors, ill-bred persons, and detractors, even in Athens, of species remarkably corresponding to the English, and not yet made endurable by being classic. And altogether, with my present fastidious nostril, I feel that I am the better off for possessing Athenian life solely as an inodorous fragment of antiquity. As to Sappho's Mytilene, while I am convinced that the Lesbian capital held some plain men of middle stature and slow conversational powers, the addition of myself to their number, though clad in the majestic folds of Hymation and without cravat, would have hardly made a sensation among the accomplished fair ones who were so precise in adjusting their own drapery about their delicate ankles. Whereas, being another sort of person in the present age, I might have given it some needful theoretic clue, or I might have poured forth poetic strains which would have anticipated theory and seemed a voice from the prophetic souls of the wide world dreaming of things to come. Or I might have been one of those benignant, lovely souls who, without astonishing the public and posterity, make a happy difference in the lives close around them, and in this way lift the average of earthly joy. In some form or other I might have been so filled from the store of universal existence that I should have been freed from the empty wishing which is like a child's cry to be inside a golden cloud, its imagination being too ignorant to figure the lining of dimness and damp. On the whole, though, there is some rash boasting about enlightenment and an occasional insistence on an originality which is that of the present year's corn crop. We seem too much disposed to indulge, and to call by complimentary names a greater charity for other portions of the human race than for our contemporaries. All reverence and gratitude for the worthy dead on whose labors we have entered, all care for the future generations whose lot we are preparing, but some affection and fairness for those who are doing the actual work of the world, some attempt to regard them with the same freedom from ill temper, whether on private or public grounds, as we may hope will be felt by those who will call us ancient some day. Otherwise, the looking before and after, which is our grand human privilege, is in danger of turning to a sort of otherworldliness, breeding a more illogical indifference or bitterness than was ever bred by the ascetic's contemplation of heaven. Except on the ground of a primitive golden age and continuous degeneracy, I see no rational footing for scorning the whole present population of the globe, unless I scorn every previous generation from whom they have inherited their diseases of mind and body, and by consequence scorn my own scorn, which is equally an inheritance of mixed ideas and feelings concocted for me in the boiling cauldron of this universally contemptible life, and so on, scorning to infinity. This may represent some actual states of mind, for it is a narrow prejudice of mathematicians to suppose that ways of thinking are to be driven out of the field by being reduced to an absurdity. The absurd is taken as an excellent juicy thistle by many constitutions. Reflections of this sort have gradually determined me not to grumble at the age in which I happen to have been born, a natural tendency certainly older than Hesiod. Many ancient, beautiful things are lost. Many ugly modern things have arisen. But invert the proposition, and it is equally true. I, at least, am a modern with some interest in advocating tolerance, and notwithstanding an inborn beguilement which carries my affection and regret continually into an imagined past, I am aware that I must lose all sense of moral proportion unless I keep alive a stronger attachment to what is near and a power of admiring what I best know and understand. Hence, this question of wishing to be rid of one's contemporaries associates itself with my filial feeling and calls up the thought that I might as justifiably wish that I had had other parents than those whose loving tones are my earliest memory, and whose last parting first taught me the meaning of death. I feel bound to quell such a wish as blasphemy. Besides, there are other reasons why I am contented that my father was a country parson, born much about the same time as Scott and Wordsworth, notwithstanding certain qualms I have felt at the fact that the property on which I am living was saved out of tithe before the period of commutation, and without the provisional transfiguration into a modus. It has sometimes occurred to me, when I have been taking a slice of excellent ham, that from a too tenable point of view I was breakfasting on a small, squealing black pig, which more than half a century ago was the unwilling representative of spiritual advantages not otherwise acknowledged by the grudging farmer or dairyman who parted with him. One enters on a fearful labyrinth in tracing compound interest backward, and such complications of thought have reduced the flavor of the ham. But since I have nevertheless eaten it, the chief effect has been to moderate the severity of my radicalism, which was not part of my paternal inheritance, and to raise the assuaging reflection that if the pig and the parishioner had been intelligent enough to anticipate my historical point of view, they would have seen themselves and the rector in a light that would have made the tithe voluntary. Notwithstanding such drawbacks, I am rather fond of the mental furniture I got by having a father who was well acquainted with all ranks of his neighbors, and am thankful that he was not one of those aristocratic clergymen who could not have sat down to a meal with any family in the parish except my lord's. Still more, that he was not an earl or a marquis. A chief misfortune of high birth is that it usually shuts a man out from the large sympathetic knowledge of human experience which comes from contact with various classes on their own level. And in my father's time, that entail of social ignorance had not been disturbed as we see it now. To look always from overhead at the crowd of one's fellow men must be in many ways incapacitating, even with the best will and intelligence. The serious blunders it must lead to in the effort to manage them for the good, one may see clearly by the mistaken ways people take of flattering and enticing those whose associations are unlike their own. Hence I have always thought that the most fortunate Britons are those whose experience has given them a practical share in many aspects of the national lot, who have lived long among the mixed commonality, roughing it with them under difficulties, knowing how their food tastes to them, and getting acquainted with their notions and motives, not by inference from traditional types and literature or from philosophical theories, but from daily fellowship and observation. Of course, such experience is apt to get antiquated, and my father might find himself much at a loss among a mixed rural population of the present day, but he knew very well what could be wisely expected from the miners, the weavers, the field laborers, and farmers of his own time. Yes, and from the aristocracy, for he had been brought up in close contact with them and had been companion to a young nobleman who was deaf and dumb. "A clergyman, lad," he used to say to me, "should feel in himself a bit every class." And this theory had a felicitous agreement with his inclination and practice, which certainly answered in making him beloved by his parishioners. They grumbled at their obligations toward him, but what then? It was natural to grumble at any demand for payment, tithe included. But also natural for a rector to desire his tithe and look well after the levying. A Christian pastor who did not mind about his money was not an ideal prevalent among the rural minds of fat central England, and might have seemed to introduce a dangerous laxity of supposition about Christian laymen who happened to be creditors. My father was none the less beloved because he was understood to be of a saving disposition. And how could he save without getting his tithe? The sight of him was not unwelcome at any door, and he was remarkable among the clergy of his district for having no lasting feud with rich or poor in his parish. I profited by his popularity, and for months after my mother's death, when I was a little fellow of 9, I was taken care of first at one homestead and then at another, a variety which I enjoyed much more than my stay at the Hall, where there was a tutor. Afterwards, for several years, I was my father's constant companion in his outdoor business, riding by his side on my little pony and listening to the lengthy dialogues he held with Darby or Joan, the one on the road or in the fields, the other outside or inside her door. In my earliest remembrance of him, his hair was already gray, for I was his youngest as well as his only surviving child, and it seemed to me that advanced age was appropriate to a father, as indeed in all respects I considered him a parent so much to my honor that the mention of my relationship to him was likely to secure me regard among those to whom I was otherwise a stranger. My father's stories from his life, including so many names of distant persons, that my imagination placed no limit to his acquaintanceship. He was a pithy talker, and his sermons bore marks of his own composition. It's true they must have been already old when I began to listen to them, and they were no more than a year's supply, so that they recurred as regularly as the collects. But though this system has been much ridiculed, I am prepared to defend it as equally sound with that of a liturgy, and even if my researches had shown me that some of my father's yearly sermons had been copied out from works of elder divines, this would only have been another proof of his good judgment. One may prefer fresh eggs, though laid by a fowl of the meanest understanding, but why fresh sermons? Nor can I be sorry, though myself given to meditative, if not active, innovation, that my father was a Tory, who had not exactly a dislike to innovators and dissenters, but a slight opinion of them, as persons of ill-founded self-confidence. When my young years gathered many details concerning those who might perhaps have called themselves the more advanced thinkers in our nearest market town, tending to convince me that their characters were quite as mixed as those of the thinkers behind them. This circumstance of my rearing has at least delivered me from certain mistakes of classification which I observe in many of my superiors, who have, apparently, no affectionate memories of a goodness mingled with what they now regard as outworn prejudices. Indeed, my philosophical notions, such as they are, continually carry me back to the time when the fitful gleams of a spring day used to show me my own shadow as that of a small boy on a small pony, riding by the side of a larger cob-mounted shadow over the breezy uplands, which we used to dignify with the name of hills, or along byroads with broad grassy borders and hedgerows reckless of utility, on our way to outlying hamlets whose groups of inhabitants were as distinctive to my imagination as if they had belonged to different regions of the globe. From these we sometimes rode onward to the adjoining parish, where also my father officiated, for he was a pluralist, but I hasten to add, on the smallest scale, for his one extra living was a poor vicarage, with hardly 50 parishioners, and its church would have made a very shabby barn. the grey worm-eaten wood of its pews and pulpits, with their doors only half hanging on the hinges, being exactly the colour of a lean mouse, which I once observed as an interesting member of the scant congregation, and conjectured to be the identical church mouse I had heard referred to as an example of extreme poverty. For I was a precocious boy, and often reasoned after the fashion of my elders, arguing that Jack and Jill were real personages in our parish, and that if I could identify Jack, I should find on him the marks of a broken crown. Sometimes, when I am in a crowded London drawing room, for I am a town bird now, acquainted with smoky eaves and tasting nature in the parks, quick flights of memory take me back among my father's parishioners while I am still conscious of elbowing men who wear the same evening uniform as myself, and I presently begin to wonder what varieties of history lie hidden under the monotony of aspect. Some of them, perhaps, belong to families with many quarterings, but how many quarterings of diverse contact with their fellow countrymen enter into these qualifications to be parliamentary leaders, professors of social science, or journalistic guides of the popular mind? Not that I feel myself a person made competent by experience. On the contrary, I argue that since an observation of different ranks has still left me practically a poor creature, what must be the condition of those who object even to read about the life of other British classes than their own? But of my elbowing neighbors with their crushed hats, I usually imagine that the most distinguished among them have probably had a far more instructive journey into manhood than my own. Here perhaps is a thought-worn physiognomy, seeming at the present moment to be classed as a mere species of white cravat and swallowtail, which may once, like Faraday's, have shown itself in curiously dubious embryonic form, leaning against a cottage lintel in small corduroys and hungrily eating a bit of brown bread and bacon. There is a pair of eyes, now too much wearied by the gaslight of public assemblies, that once perhaps learned to read their native England through the same alphabet as mine, not within the boundaries of an ancestral park, never even being driven through the county town 5 miles off, but among the Midland villages and markets, along by the tree-studded hedgerows, and where the heavy barges seem in the distance to float mysteriously among the rushes and the feathered grass. Our vision, both real and ideal, has since then been filled with far other scenes, among eternal snows and stupendous sun-scorched monuments of departed empires, within the scent of the long orange groves, and where the Temple of Neptune looks out over the siren-haunted sea. But my eyes, at least, have kept their early affectionate joy in our native landscape, which is one deep root of our national life and language. And I often smile at my consciousness that certain conservative prepossessions have mingled themselves for me with the influences of our Midland scenery, from the tops of the elms down to the buttercups and the little wayside vetches, naturally enough. That part of my father's prime to which he oftenest referred had fallen on the days when the great wave of political enthusiasm and belief in a speedy regeneration of all things had ebbed, and the supposed millennial initiative of France was turning into a Napoleonic empire, the sway of an Attila with a mouth speaking proud things in a jargon half revolutionary, half Roman. Men were beginning to shrink timidly from the memory of their own words and from the recognition of the fellowships they had formed 10 years before. And even reforming Englishmen, for the most part, were willing to wait for the perfection of society, if only they could keep their throats perfect and help to drive away the chief enemy of mankind from our coasts. To my father's mind, the noisy teachers of revolutionary doctrine were, to speak mildly, a variable mix of the fool and the scoundrel. The welfare of the nation lay in a strong government which could maintain order, and I was accustomed to hear him utter the word government in a tone that charged it with awe and made it part of my effective religion, in contrast with the word rebel, which seemed to carry the stamp of evil in its syllables, and, lit by the fact that Satan was the first rebel, made an argument dispensing with more detailed inquiry. I gathered that our national troubles in the first two decades of the century were not at all due to the mistakes of our administrators, and that England, with its fine church and constitution, would have been exceedingly well off if every British subject had been thankful for what was provided and minded his own business. If, for example, numerous Catholics of that period had been aware how very modest they ought to be, considering they were Irish. The times, I heard, had often been bad, but I was constantly hearing of bad times as a name for actual evenings and mornings when the godfathers who gave them that name appeared to me remarkably comfortable. Altogether, my father's England seemed to me lovable, laudable, full of good men, and having good rulers from Mr. Pitt on to the Duke of Wellington, until he was for emancipating the Catholics. And it was so far from prosaic to me that I looked into it for a more exciting romance than such as I could find in my own adventures, which consisted mainly in fancied crises calling for the resolute wielding of domestic swords and firearms against unapparent robbers, rioters, and invaders, who, it seemed, in my father's prime, had more chance of being real. The Morris dancers had not then dwindled to a ragged and almost vanished rout, owing the traditional name probably to the historic fancy of our superannuated groom. Also, the good old king was alive and well, which made all the difference, because I had no notion what he was and did, only understanding in general that if he had been still on the throne, he would have hindered everything that wise persons thought undesirable. Certainly that elder England, with its frankly saleable boroughs, so cheap compared with the seats obtained under the reformed method, and its boroughs kindly presented by noblemen desirous to encourage gratitudes, its prisons, with a miscellaneous company of felons and maniacs, and without any supply of water, its bloated, idle charities, its non-resident jovial clergy, its militia balloting, and above all its blank ignorance of what we, its posterity, should be thinking of it, has great differences from the England of today. Yet we discern a strong family likeness. Is there any country which shows at once as much stability and as much susceptibility to change as ours? Our national life is like that scenery which I early learned to love, not subject to great convulsions, but easily showing more or less delicate, sometimes melancholy, effects from minor changes. Hence, our Midland plains have never lost their familiar expression and conservative spirit for me, yet at every other mile since I first looked on them, some sign of worldwide change, some new direction of human labor, has wrought itself into what one may call the speech of the landscape, in contrast with those grander and vaster regions of the earth which keep an indifferent aspect in the presence of men's toil and devices. What does it signify that a Lilliputian train passes over a viaduct amidst the abysses of the Apennines, or that a caravan, laden with a nation's offerings, creeps across the unresting sameness of the desert, or that a petty cloud of steam sweeps for an instant over the face of an Egyptian colossus, immovably submitting to its slow burial beneath the sand. But our woodlands and pastures, our hedge-parted cornfields and meadows, our bits of high common where we used to plant the windmills, our quiet little rivers here and there fit to turn a millwheel, our villages along the old coach roads are all easily alterable lineaments that seem to make the face of our motherland sympathetic with the laborious lives of her children. She does not take their plows and wagons contemptuously, but rather makes every hovel and every sheepfold, every railed bridge or fallen tree trunk, an agreeably noticeable incident, not a mere speck in the midst of unmeasured vastness, but a piece of our social history in pictorial writing. Our rural tracts, where no babble chimney scales the heavens, are without mighty objects to fill the soul with the sense of an outer world unconquerably aloof from our efforts. The wastes are playgrounds, and let us try to keep them such for the children's children who will inherit no other sort of domain. The grasses and reeds nod to each other over the river, but we have cut a canal close by. The very heights laugh with corn in August, or lift the plow team against the sky in September. Then comes a crowd of burly navvies with pickaxes and barrows, and while hardly a wrinkle is made in the fading mother's face or a new curve of health in the blooming girls, the hills are cut through or the breaches between them spanned. We choose our level, and the white-steamed pennon flies along it. But because our land shows this readiness to be changed, all signs of permanence upon it raise a tender attachment instead of awe. Some of us, at least, love the scanty relics of our forests, and are thankful if a bush is left of the old hedgerow. A crumbling bit of wall, where the delicate ivy-leaved toad flax hangs its light branches, or a bit of gray thatch with patches of dark moss on its shoulder and a troop of grass stems on its ridge, is a thing to visit. And then the tiled roof of cottage and homestead, of the long cowshed where generations of the milky mothers have stood patiently, of the broad-shouldered barns where the old-fashioned flail once made resonant music, while the watchdog barked at the timidly venturesome fowls making pecking raids on the outflying grain. The roofs that have looked out from among the elms and walnut trees, or beside the yearly group of hay and corn stacks, or below the square stone steeple, gathering their gray or ochre-tinted lichens and their olive-green mosses under all ministries. Let us praise the sober harmonies they give to our landscape, helping to unite us pleasantly with the elder generations who tilled the soil for us before we were born, and paid heavier and heavier taxes with much grumbling, but without that deepest root of corruption, the self-indulgent despair which cuts down and consumes and never plants. But I check myself. Perhaps this England of my affections is half visionary, a dream in which things are connected according to my well-fed, lazy mood, and not at all by the multitudinous links of graver, sadder facts, such as belong everywhere to the story of human labor. Well, well, the illusions that began for us when we were less acquainted with evil have not lost their value when we discern them to be illusions. They feed the ideal better, and in loving them still, we strengthen the precious habit of loving something not visibly, tangibly existent, but a spiritual product of our visible, tangible selves. I cherish my childish loves, the memory of that warm little nest where my affections were fledged. Since then, I have learned to care for foreign countries, for literatures foreign and ancient, for the life of continental towns dozing round old cathedrals, for the life of London, half sleepless with eager thought and strife, with indigestion or with hunger. And now my consciousness is chiefly of the busy, anxious, metropolitan sort. My system responds sensitively to the London weather signs, political, social, literary, and my bachelor's hearth is embedded where, by much craning of head and neck, I can catch sight of a sycamore in the square garden. I belong to the nation of London. Why? There have been many voluntary exiles in this world, and probably in the very first exodus of the patriarchal Aryans, for I am determined not to fetch my examples from races whose talk is of uncles and no fathers. Some of those who sallied forth went for the sake of a loved companionship, when they would willingly have kept sight of the familiar plains and of the hills to which they had first lifted up their eyes. End of chapter 2.